Hi, and welcome to the Soul Awakening Podcast. I'm your host, Kat Fowler, and today we are talking all about psychology. My guest today is a breath of wisdom and takes a completely untraditional yet very holistic approach to psychotherapy and healing. Dr. Nicole LaPera was trained in clinical psychology at Cornell University and the New School. She is a holistic psychologist who founded the Mindful Healing Center in Philadelphia. Her work addresses the connection between the mind and the body and incorporates nutrition, lifestyle, and psychological wellness practices. She recently expanded her work online, creating a platform for teaching these often overlooked components of mental wellness to individuals and practitioners around the world. So, Dr. Nicole, thank you so much for coming onto the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, Kat. It's truly an honor.
I'm so excited to talk to you because you are, number one, every single one of your posts, I feel like I'm learning. It's one of those things that the community you've created online, it's not just this community where people like the quotes that you post or whatever. It's like everybody's learning something. A lot of people are doing the homework and the work themselves. And so I just want to thank you for that because it's just, I think it's such a beautiful thing that people are becoming really self-aware from a lot of what you, the content you put out.
I really, really appreciate you saying that. And to be honest, creating a community was one of my huge motivators when I jumped on the platform of social media. I had no idea it would take off to the extent that it has. But I mean, I am every time I see the community engaging and sharing and walking this journey together, I am just beyond elated. So
yeah. What's your Instagram handle again? It's
The Holistic Psychologist.
That's right. And the hashtag, which I love, is self-healers.
Yes, self-healers.
Yes. I mean, I literally think every time you posted a post, I've commented with that target emoji, like 100% on point.
I love it.
Yeah. And so I'm just really excited to talk to you because I feel like you're one of the few therapists or psychologists that I've spoken with that actually have and allow themselves to have a spiritual practice and have a spiritual kind of standpoint. And that's kind of how you operate. That's what's behind a lot of what you do. And I followed your journey a bit, but for those of you that are newer to you, can you speak to a little bit of your journey? Because I know that you kind of almost publicly advocate against talk therapy. And so if you could just speak about like how you got to where you are with that and your practice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so I, like you read in my intro, which I appreciate, I was trained very traditionally, meaning so that everyone out there who, you know, kind of has had experience with a psychologist or has an idea, talk is very much you come, you sit on the couch and you talk. And it's not that I advocate against it per se, but, you know, my hashtag that I do put out there is self-healers because I do not feel that it is a necessary component of healing. I think it can be incredibly helpful piece of it. So a little bit about my journey and how I came to this belief ties this in. So I am someone who myself, as the person that I am, I have struggled with anxiety for as long as I can remember. Was a very anxious child. My 20s were, you know, kind of peppered with really debilitating feeling panic attacks. I myself was in talk therapy. I was medicated. I had the belief that there was, you know, just something quote unquote, you know, wrong with me that I would always have to just manage. Mm-hmm. A big breakthrough and a big shift in the way that I practiced really came when I had started to have some pretty scary little background. My anxiety, my personal based anxiety was very much health related, a lot of fear around health and catastrophe. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. When I started having health issues, as you can imagine, mm-hmm. I got scared and I thought something was clearly wrong with me. Mm-hmm. I was fainting. I was having really weird kind of brain blanking moments. It was just the most bizarre. And at that point, I knew that there was something going on. I really dove into research to try to figure out what was going on with me. And at that point, my world opened to lifestyle and the things that I was eating and the choices that I was making and the role that that might have been playing in my symptoms that I was having. So I at that point embarked on my own self-healing journey.
And you were already a therapist when this is all going on.
I was already a therapist. So I was practicing very traditionally. Mm-hmm. And I, at this point, I was logging, you know, a pretty significant hours with the clients that I was working with. And by this point, not only was I finding that my anxiety was not yet healed until, obviously, like I said, I made those lifestyle changes, but I was feeling stuck right alongside of a lot of the people that I had been treating at this point for years. Mm-hmm. So once I realized and made the shift and really got, you know, was able to get a balance back, you know, physiologically in my body. And then that allowed me to really dive into, I'm very fascinated with the subconscious and the subconscious's role in keeping us stuck. At that point, I realized I have to change the way that I'm working. So it's not that I don't think talking is helpful. I for sure think that exploring our feelings and getting them out verbally and having, you know, a third party or a second, whatever you want to call it, an outside observer, the therapist or whomever the clinician is, right? That can really be helpful to point out things that we cannot see ourselves. However, I do think that sometimes there are limits, because if you're not doing these more holistic or healing the imbalances that maybe are in our bodies, or, you know, really exploring the subconscious and that role, that I think a lot of us will just remain stuck in often really frustrating ways.
So funny, because I actually had a similar journey as a yoga teacher and a meditation teacher. I was doing that for about 10 years. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm very even keeled. I've got no issues, but I had a very traumatic childhood. And out of nowhere, once I hit around 30, 10 years into doing all these mindfulness practices and whatnot and teaching it, I had my own issues with panic and anxiety and similarly health things where I didn't necessarily have a health issue, but I thought I did. Like, I constantly did. And I thought I was going to die at all moments. That's how bad it got at some point. It was real bad. And like agoraphobia, the whole thing. And I was like, what is happening? If I'm teaching and somewhat practicing these like holistic practices, something is not, this is not working. And really, I realized was this unlocked trauma that just all of a sudden happened. It just was trauma that was so deeply stored in the subconscious, in my body. And at, I believe when things like this come up, it's because we're ready to work with it and ready to heal it. And similarly, I was like, okay, what I'm doing is not working. Let me take a big rehaul and really, really go in and see what's going on. And it was an entire journey. But yeah, I think it's these like, I call them surrender moments, where you kind of just like are thrown down to your knees and you're like, all right, well, let's see, because what I'm doing is not working. And I think that's really interesting, because it's also, you were in the role of the therapist, I was in the role of the teacher, and you've got to keep your shit together, honestly, when you're like working with clients. And it's almost like you feel this inability to communicate with others about what you're going through, because you're in the seat of the teacher or the therapist. And then I love what you do, especially online, because you really are just vulnerable with saying like, oh no, I believe that the dynamic is actually shouldn't necessarily be, you speak actually a lot about the dynamic between someone with credentials or like they're the expert talking to the client, yet it's kind of two humans working together. Can you speak a little bit to that? Because you've done a few posts on that I found really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to kind of expand upon what you're saying, because there's a, whether you're at this point, you know, there's a lot of, I guess, designations, degrees that allow you to treat, right? You have the master's level, the marriage and family, the PhD level, right? So a lot of people are working as healers in the mental wellness field, as I'm in, right? And I can't speak for obviously all of the programming, but I do know that a large part of the program of the schooling, if you will, of the models that I was taught in that schooling system were actually advising against being a human in the room, not disclosing, right? Not being a person, being, if you will, I think the standard way some of us might have heard of it called like the blank slate, right? So I want to expand on that and say that, yeah, I mean, not only, you know, is there a power dynamic there, but actually a lot of us are being taught, you know, not to share certain aspects of ourselves. I have always kind of been a little bit more, you know, kind of flexible in terms of disclosure, meaning, you know, I've always, you know, shared pieces of me or allowed myself to be known to some extent, not the extent that I am now doing so. But yeah, I mean, I just think that, I mean, I have the belief that, you know, what the ultimate goal of any healing process or relationship ultimately is to allow the person who's already more or less the expert, if you will, on themselves to just become more of an expert. And I don't think that happens, you know, with that kind of differential teacher, I have something that you need model. And back to the hashtag that, you know, I feel very passionately about, I don't think that, I do believe that every person has the capability to know themselves and heal themselves. And does not need to look up or to hold a person in a regard as if they have something that the person can't have. Like I said earlier, though, yes, an outside observer can be helpful, but I think that there's just, it's a dangerous area where we can fall into more of, I guess, a dependency if we feel that the only person can help us, right, is the person who sits in the chair on the other side of the couch.
And I've seen several therapists myself, and I just remember having these moments of knowing the ones that I felt really empowered with when I'm given like homework, I ask a lot of questions, they're able to answer those questions. And also there's no advice given in the sense where I know that I've given my power away when I'm in a dynamic where I'm asking them what to do. And I think that means that I'm completely not in touch with my intuition and also being misguided, because nobody, like you said, is going to know better for what to do with your life than yourself, truly, with your intuition. And once you really get in touch with that and you've removed some of those layers of really deep trauma and things like that, that can be released through talk therapy or just many other ways. So yeah, I totally agree with that. And I know also you talk a lot about the labeling that goes on and the profiling, and especially when it comes to like disorders and things like that. Can you speak a little bit to your feelings on that, like the DSM, and what it's like when you have someone walk into your room that you've never met, and what you're really technically taught or trained to do, and how you feel that really affects the healing process and the client interaction?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so we are, I mean, the DSM essentially for someone that goes through a program like myself is our Bible. I mean, so we are essentially taught, aside, of course, from the logistical pieces of if anyone out there is working with any practitioner that is works with insurance. I mean, obviously there's the codes and all of that that's very much intricately related to the DSM. So aside from that, I mean, we are taught that there are these categories, you know, of issues, illnesses, you know, disorders, quote unquote, I'm putting air quotes up, whatever you want to call them, you know, that people more or less can neatly fall in. And if you check 7 out of the 8 boxes or 5, you know, whatever, then you have this thing. And then attached to that thing, there's a, you know, kind of prescribed treatment, if you will, a type of thing that we do, whether it's medication or a version of a talk therapy, a CBT, et cetera. So it's funny because looking back, I've always been a little hesitant. I was fascinated, of course, when I was first given the DSM very early in my school to look at it and learn it, and because I just love the mind. But the more I really started to work with people, I started to realize that, you know, I shied away from it. I didn't really find it as important or as integral, as critical. So I say all of this to acknowledge that, yes, there are people out there that I believe that if they have a name to give to what they're struggling with, right? So if I have all these symptoms and someone says, okay, you have depression, I think that that can benefit some of us to some extent. Oh, okay, I have a name for what is wrong with me, you know, quote unquote, or, you know, and I think that that can be relieving. Maybe it can point people into a direction of other people who speak the same language. It gives a shared language. I, however, think that there is a limit to where that is helpful and where it shifts into possibly not helpful. And I think it becomes unhelpful to the extent that we then as a human identify with the diagnosis. We make it something that's inherently part of our person. And furthermore, the danger becomes we wrap it up in our identity to the extent that we can't imagine a scenario or a future where that's not part of our lived experience. And I do not believe that these diagnoses, if you will, are lifetime or need to be, you know, kind of a lifetime sentence. I've seen so much healing of people who might have met, if we want to go by the DSM, right, diagnostic criteria for depression, anxiety, etc., you know, that ultimately when they've really kind of done the work would not check those boxes anymore.
Yeah, and there's just also this interesting fact that the DSM changes all the time. So it's like
it surprisingly expands.
Right.
Do with that information what you will. You know what I mean?
And there's also this socioeconomic factor where if you can afford to see a therapist and be diagnosed, then you have something. And like there's this funny quote, you have the money to be crazy. Like, whereas then there's probably tons of people out there and we just really don't know the real numbers, because it is kind of, unless insurance is involved for some cases, like a financial thing. And so there's just so many funny things with the statistics around diagnoses and the DSM and how it expands and how they just take things out sometimes. And it's like, oh, so you're not this anymore? Like this one label, it's an interesting thing to think about. And so a lot of your work, though, online is you really talk about the healing journey, which I think is what really draws people to you, because it's this focus on the healing journey and really describing it so people understand what that's like and they don't feel so alone. And so I'm just going to read one of the quotes that you wrote that I really loved. It says, "Healing is the pattern of unlearning and relearning. It's returning to what you've always been underneath conditioning, pure consciousness." So I love that so much. And I want to know what the healing journey has been like for you and what's kind of the typical progression or the things that you'll see on a client going through a healing journey.
Yeah, absolutely. I thank you for pointing that out. And that quote, I do, you know, I describe the healing journey as, you know, peeling back the layers of the onion, because I think a lot of what we see as the adult self that many of us are, you know, is some version somewhere on the spectrum, in my belief, a disconnection from our true self, based on the accumulation of our past experiences that then become habit. They then become who we are, our personality, however it is that you want to describe it. But I do agree, like I said, that is, and for some of us, it's quite far off from who we are kind of authentically underneath of things. So for my own journey, it was really marked with, and it sounds somewhat similar to the experience you had, for a long time, while I knew I was anxious, and I could observe, have a, you know, remember observing my mom, and I know to some extent my mom was anxious, but if you were to have asked me, you know, kind of my childhood life, you know, I would have said everything was really great, you know? And I think what that illustrates is the protection that a lot of us put in place when things were not so great. Meaning there's a part of our psyche, if you will, you know, our ego, our emotional experience that adapts, I believe, in a very, you know, kind of savvy way as a child or whenever it is that, you know, these experiences have happened to us to allow us to continue to be. You know, and then we live those adaptations and we carry those adaptations into our adult self. And I think the first layer of healing, outside of, like I will always say, making sure that we're using tools to make sure that our body is in balance and we're developing a mindfulness practice and an awareness, because awareness and consciousness is a huge part of the journey. I think psychologically, one of the biggest parts of the journey is almost like a radical honesty of the self. So I use my example because very early on, and I think you're right, I loved how you said that, you know, things bubble to the surface when we're ready, you know. So as I started to, I guess, be ready, unbeknownst to me, you know, I started to have some realizations that really made me question the quote unquote reality that I, or the story, if you will, that I had been telling myself about where I came from, who I was, how I was. So I think that's really one of the biggest first stages, and often a very, very painful one, because when we're not defending in the way that we've adapted to doing so, and we're really trying to look and understand, you know, why we're seeing the habits or the ways of being that are keeping us stuck, often along with that comes a lot of realizations, you know, about some pretty difficult things. So I think that's a huge, huge, big first part of the journey. I'm going to simplify this entirely. So that's the first half, ultimately, right? And then the second half is about, okay, now what? You know, now that I know all of this and I kind of have come up with this concept of reparenting, if you will, you know, now it's about identifying the needs and the adaptations that we made to those needs as a child, and now meeting the needs not only ourselves, but with our much more adult, mature coping systems that were not available to us at that younger age. So I guess it's like a two very simplified part journey.
Would you say that everybody has an inner child wound, even people that have had like very easy breezy childhoods?
100%, because we are humans. We are humans raising humans, and it is of no ill intention, you know, of our caregivers. You know, often it is not, you know, something. It is just, we are just people transmitting, you know, our patterns and our ways of being, despite the best of intentions at times, onto other people. So yes, there is some still childlike part of all of us, and obviously those of us who have lived a more traumatic past experience, you know, those become much more problematic. But yeah, I think that the inner child is there for all of us.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about, but from almost the client perspective of literally having to go through, like you said, this like veil being removed, seeing it and really hearing a lot of the things that happened when I was really young that I maybe even didn't remember. And then obviously really looking at things in a different perspective, because as a child, like you said, we in a very savvy way, we cope, but it's for our survival because it's our caregivers and we can't live without these people at that moment. So it's like, that's our mind and that's how it's formed. And then we become an adult and we have all these guilt complexes over what happened. We take full responsibility as the child even, and you have to like actually literally retrain yourself depending on how severe the trauma is. And I had to do this for myself to take away the guilt and to realize that the things that were happening were not, I had no responsibility when I was like 2 or 4 years old or whatever it was. And it's such a crazy thing to be like, wow, I'm an adult now. And now I'm going to actually have to retrain my mind and look at the story. And like you said, it's like this, and I think, you know, that's what therapists are really helpful for. It's seeing the coping mechanisms that you have, because I think, you know, obviously we all operate with them at some point, and trying to unlearn that. It's almost like I compared it to feeling like I was crawling again instead of walking. It was like I had to relearn this whole element of emotional intelligence and operating from a place that wasn't intellectualizing everything or whatever it was. And it was this whole journey. You feel like you're way behind societally, as you should, when you start to go through this, but it's really, you're not. You're probably way ahead of society because you're not just in the dark, just operating on autopilot. So can you speak a little bit to some examples, because you do a lot of posts on this, on inner child wounding, and what is an example of that? How would that look like? Because I know you talk a lot about the mother wound, the father wound, and then also just reparenting and what that kind of process is like.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can, you know, kind of speak using my own individual journey. And I love how you kind of worded that. And I always commend people that, you know, are on this journey, you know, whether I'm working with them or they're following along on my Instagram or not. Because, I mean, to speak to your point, you're right, Kat. Some people will walk their entire time on this planet, on this earth, right, and not look at this, because there is something that, you know, we get so adapted to the familiar, even if the familiar is not getting us the life that we want, you know, we go on autopilot. There is a lot of value, and I make an argument down to the way our brain works, of autopilot. So, I mean, to speak to your point, I think anyone who is looking at themselves in this honest way and evolving in this way is, you know, kind of taking a huge step and is, if you will, beyond, you know. But so in terms of my own experience with all things inner child, my mom is pretty emotionally detached. She uses detachment, I believe, based on her own, you know, past traumas, and she has pretty significant ones, you know, in there. So now that I think I've become aware as a child, I did not have, you know, kind of her there emotionally available to me, connecting with me, you know, kind of seeing me and understanding me and holding space for me as an emotional being. So one of the ways that this continues to play out for me now, so I know that there's a little girl in me, and this comes out a lot, as it often does for many of us, in the context of relationships. When I am in conflict or feeling, you know, upset, however we want to define upset, right, in my relationships, you'll usually hear some version of a complaint lodged on my end, you know, saying something along the lines of, you don't understand, right? So as I've really dove into that, I come to realize what I mean in those moments is, you don't understand, you don't see me, right? So that little child who's not seen and heard and understood, I carry with me. And outside of obviously the conflict in relationships, the way that I see this playing forth as well is being on the platform that I'm on now, you know, being seen and understood. I actually just had a consult call with someone this morning, and it was so sweet. She was so excited to talk to me, and she was saying all these amazing, crazy, nice things about me as a person. And I noticed, I was like, oh, there's part of me that felt weird. I felt almost uncomfortable. And I'm realizing, so these are all the moments where I'm now able to identify, right, from my awareness that is now adult Nicole, that in those moments where that discomfort is coming from for me is that little child who was not actually seen and heard by, I mean, one of the most important caregivers, you know, when we are young, is the one that's immediately responsible for our needs, which, you know, for some of us is mom or some of us is dad, but for me, it was my mom. And because she wasn't there, you know, that for me now, my journey is twofold, is being aware, right? Tapping into the awareness that is me, adult me now, in those moments to know that when I'm feeling uncomfortable, that's where it's coming from, right? It doesn't have to mean that something's inherently uncomfortable about the situation or wrong in my relationship, right? That is just little child me screaming out in discomfort for being seen and heard, but so desperately wanting it. And then ultimately my goal of reparenting myself, if you will, now, is to give myself the feeling of being seen, heard, and understood separate from anyone else. Meaning I don't need anyone else to provide that feeling for me. I am sufficient enough to give myself that feeling and to see and hear and understand myself. And that's going to be, I think, the longest part of the journey, me working to resolve that aspect of my child wound.
Mm-hmm. And can you speak a little bit to the father wound? Like what an example of that would be like.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, you know, gender aside, you know, I think that it really depends on the dynamic of the roles that the mother, the father that are playing, you know, in our lives. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of overlap. I say that to say there's a lot of overlap and similarity essentially, you know, in terms. So if your father was your primary caregiver or the one that you looked for love for, but always felt rejected, you know, or it could equally have been mom. So there's a lot of overlap in that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that, you know, for me, I guess my father wound, if you will, you know, really inherently is more connected to, I see my dad, and I guess adult me, I should now say, understands the role that my dad has played in relationship with my mom in particular, you know, as being an enabler of sorts. So, you know, part of me now as a parent, as an adult, is to reparent myself and to understand the line between enabling, you know, someone to do something and where a healthier boundary for myself could be. There's many different, you know, if you will, father wounds. There's a lot of people who might have had physically present dads, but emotionally distant dads, that might have a similar type of experience that I have in connection with my mom, trying to, you know, earn or attain a feeling of love, an unattainable to some extent, a feeling of love for dad, how this plays out in adult life. Maybe we look for unavailable partners, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And this is bringing to my mind just the feeling and the notion of just this generational trauma that begins to get healed when whoever it is in that line starts to wake up and see what's happening. Because I remember when I first started going through that myself, I had a lot of anger towards my parents. And then I had to realize that this, well, singular parent at some point, but that this came probably because they were in some way abused or they had trauma that they were dealing with, and probably the person before them and the person before them. And we're the generation now that's waking up. And we're the ones that are doing the work. But this work is what's going to heal the entire DNA, like the entire family line moving forward. No one's going to have to deal with these same issues if we're the ones that heal them.
I get chills when you say that, because I know that to be true. And that's exactly what happens. We repeat and we repeat and we repeat. And I do agree with you. There's such an inherent and longstanding healing that is available. And I agree with you. I'm seeing this generationally. I think there's a collective, you know, awakening. And I am just so hopeful and cannot wait to see the younger generations that are now being raised by more conscious and healing, if you will, caregivers. I think it's going to be incredible for, you know, humans at large, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the things that you, when you talk about working with the inner child wound and some of the results of that, that I found really interesting, and I think everybody can speak to this, because I think in one of your posts you've actually said it really affects everyone, is this distrust for yourself. It's this like self-doubt. It's this lack of listening to your own intuition and inner guidance. And can you just speak to how that happens and how to kind of move back to the journey of listening to your intuition within?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think it happens in one of two ways. It happens for some of us by observation, to speak to your point of intergenerational transmission, right? Mm-hmm. Of observing parents time and time again who are engaging in their own, the concept I always kind of coin is self-betrayal, right? Who are not trusting of themselves. But I also think it happens in this again, I almost might say, I have yet to meet a person where, to some extent, like you're saying, does everyone have a child wound? I said, yes. I mean, I do think that we all collectively have experienced, and again, laying on a spectrum, some of us more extremely, a scenario in our childhood where we begin to learn to distrust ourselves and our intuition in particular. Each time the reality, so to step it back a minute, I believe that however it is that you believe that we get here on this planet, right? Once we come to this planet as a little baby, I believe that we are a being with an intuition, right? We're connected, we're observing, we're attuned to energies. We kind of, to simplify it, we know what's going on. You know, mm-hmm. we have that inner guidance system. So what starts to happen though is as we become, you know, a little human and we start to, you know, experience and share a reality, or express, I should say, a reality to our caregivers, each time we're told that's not the reality, it's this. So for example, right, and this is a more kind of egregious example, you have a dad, I wrote this in my post, right, you have dad comes home and dad has a little bit of a drinking problem, right, mm-hmm. and little baby, however old you are, kind of gets it, like something's off with dad, right, and mom, and you say, hey mom, what's wrong with dad, or, you know, something along those lines, and mom says, nothing, dad's fine, or dad's just tired, right? Each time those micro moments happen, what you have is a child who's attuned and aware being told inherently that their reality is inaccurate. Mm-hmm. And for some of us, that happens time and time and time again, right? So before you know it, you become an adult who doesn't trust that inner guidance intuition anymore because you've been, whether it's directly or indirectly told to some extent that is inaccurate.
Mm-hmm. And then that just leads to so many things. And that can happen, I think, in schools too, right? Like not just necessarily from the parents.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It can happen in schools. And then what starts to happen furthermore and how we stop trusting ourselves is, again, for many different reasons, we start to then intend to do things or want to do things or commit to do things, if you will, and then we don't follow through. So now internally, we're almost validating that belief of I can't trust myself. Right. We have a lot of us who have started things and stopped things. And, you know, so again, I think that then what we see and experience becomes something that is internalized. But you're right. School is another area where, you know, we are our reality. If unless it falls in the tidy box that is school, mm-hmm. there's no room for it. Mm-hmm. And I think that causes a great deal of distrust in the self for children.
Yeah, and just unpacking the parents a little bit more, would you say that it's from the parents' own insecurity and them projecting that onto the child? They want the child, like you said, if their child's reality is different from what they want it to be, which is maybe a conventional follow this path, do this job, whatever it is, like have these hobbies, and the child is totally different. Would you say that that comes from a parent kind of wanting the child to be an extension of themselves for their own reasons because of the insecurity that they may have within?
Absolutely. I think that's one route to it. I think, you know, again, parents are only, sometimes it just brings up discomfort, you know, what my child is saying or doing. I'm not familiar with this. It's new. It's not me. You know, the unfamiliar, I think, could cause a reaction like that. But yeah, I think that, and it's interesting because I think we're evolving finally into an era where, you know, worrying about the neighbors is still there, but I do think it was generationally strong for some of us. And, you know, this concern and this idea that the child represents me and if I'm good or a bad parent or good or a bad person, the way the child is being in the world reflects that. So I think there's a lot of pathways, you know, to why a parent might do this. I mean, they could be just learning and have modeled what their parent did or didn't do ultimately mm-hmm. too. But yeah, I think that there's a lot of extension of self stuff that happens.
Yeah. And I think it's also just really hard on our part, on the child's part, to look at your parents in not like a glorious light, even if you know that they've done really terrible things. It's to actually be honest with yourself about like, hey, they're really imperfect people. And maybe that person that told me that I'm so awesome isn't that perfect themselves. And then you have to go through this layer of being like, who really am I? If the people that were always constantly supporting me maybe don't necessarily have the best hold on their own lives.
Yeah, 100%. I think there's, and I coined a term when I was writing the one post the other day, and this idea of hero worship. You know, I mm-hmm. think it's a defense too. I don't want to see mm-hmm. the truth. I actually had a very interesting, almost kind of opposite experience. And again, this goes way much deeper into dynamics and anger in my household and how anger was handled, et cetera. But I mean, for me, I almost erred on the side, or I should say over rationalized, you know, my parents being human, that I almost talked myself out of any negative feeling. Once I came to realize, you know, kind of what was the case for me about them, any disappointment, upset, sadness, grief, because I almost kind of went to this other extreme where I was like, okay, you know, my mom was traumatized and this is all she was capable of. And I almost did that. I have to catch myself, I should say, not to do that to my own disservice, where I allow my own feelings, you know, about not having an attentive, attached mother, you know, could bring up. I almost kind of talked myself out of them, if you will.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about dealing with emotions, because I think that's what we're talking about now. And I feel like we're very similar now. The more and more we talk, I'm like, oh, we kind of have very similar experiences. Just probably reverse parent roles. But let's talk about just that journey to accepting your emotions as valid and not running from them through things and coping mechanisms like rationalization, intellectualization, or whatever it is.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, I can make it really, really simple. I observe that we do one of two very simplified things with emotions. We go outward with them, you know, we scream, we yell, we kind of like do the thing, or we detach. We do on the other end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. My coping mechanism of preference is detachment. It's what my mom did. So I appeared, and actually you will hear my family talking and referencing me as nothing bothers Nicole, right? And it did appear that way. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, nothing did bother me because I was so removed from any emotion.
And then you have the panic attacks.
But that's the thing. The emotions, I'm going to tell everyone out there, they don't go anywhere. That's the thing. They're not there. You know what I mean? So they're either making you physically ill. They're coming up in your patterns. Right. You know, they're evident in the choices you're making. You know, so for me, my 20s were rift with drinking and drugging, because that's a great way to detach. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's what that looked like. So it wasn't that nothing bothered me. It was just it came out differently. So I think as part of our journeys, it's to not only get more in touch with the emotional side of ourselves. And we all have emotions. They're a human reality. And they're quite helpful. They could be teachers, you know, if we learn how to experience them, observe them, be with them, you know, take them for what they are. They can help guide us, you know, at times. But so I think not only do we need to make space for our emotions, but we really need to be aware of the choices that we're making based on our emotions. So for me, it's really about reconnecting with my full emotional experience, you know, not using that ultimate checkout, you know, coping mechanism, and teaching myself, because this is another thing, implicitly, right? If I've checked out my entire life because the emotions were just too powerful, too strong when I was too little to deal with them, I can now. However, checking out, even in and of itself, in my perspective at least, gives me, my entity that is Nicole, right, an implicit message that I can't handle them, right? So now a big part of my journey is to unlearn that message and to teach myself, to relearn that I can handle them, that I can feel all which ways of Sunday, and it might suck, but I will be okay, ultimately, and I don't have to check out to keep myself safe anymore.
Right, to survive as a child. Yeah. And what's, because you were saying there's externalization, which is like where you're just like people screaming, whatever it is, and then detachment, like is two of the probably many different manifestations of how we cope with emotions in an unhealthy way. So what would be a healthy way of expressing things like anger or sadness and dealing with it for somebody that feels stunted or is completely really new to expressing emotion, because let's just say they were raised to never do that, or because that's just how they had to operate?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think first and foremost, right, it's making space for, I mean, how I define emotions and how they've been defined, you know, ultimately is their energies. You know, our body feels different. Maybe some of us have physiological, you know, kind of evidences. Our heart gets up, we tense, we do things like that. So I think the first, you know, important step is quite literally connecting with our bodies and feeling what they feel like in our bodies. And then obviously, you know, kind of understanding what they are. Okay, when I'm tense like this, I'm nervous. When my stomach does this thing, I'm mad, right? So really just learning the energy flow that represents each of these emotional experiences for ourselves and allowing it to be. right? We don't have to explain it away. We don't have to minimize it. We don't have to run from it. We can, I'm a big proponent of breath work. We can teach ourselves how to sit, how to breathe through it, how to maybe activate in terms of movement, how to take the walk, to shake the energy around, move it around, right? So it's about learning how to tolerate and regulate ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. And then I think step two, ultimately, like I said, emotions can be teachers and contain information. So obviously we might get to the point where the emotion that we're feeling is of value and needs to be expressed, mm-hmm. right? And then I think the next step of that is learning how to, first and foremost, not express the feeling when we're in that emotionally reactive state, because that's usually when we're not going to do our best expression. Mm-hmm. But being able to then formulate if it is an angry, right? And if I do have to tell a partner that, yo, this thing made me angry, you know, then it's giving ourselves and learning the language to communicate that mm-hmm. to others.
Mm-hmm. You're from New York.
Philadelphia.
Philadelphia? Okay. It's East Coast. That's what it is. I'm from New York too.
Accent.
Your accent, and also just you said yo, and mostly it's like a tri-state thing. So.
I love it.
So when it comes to that, this question popped into my mind. Why is it so societally unacceptable to express negative emotions? Because it's very acceptable to be happy and to be positive, and that's like all you see online is all these, the highlight reel of everyone's life. Why is it so unacceptable or so difficult, or why is this such a brave move to be vulnerable with the negative emotions? Why do you think that is, and where does that come from?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess, you know, just kind of offhand, two things that came to mind is meanings and labels that one might assign to vulnerability obviously have a more negative connotation. So a lot of people will internalize a belief that anything on a negative spectrum is weak or shouldn't be for X, Y, or Z. So I think some of it is that. And then I think some of it is the discomfort that is triggered when we see or experience someone being negative or having a negative experience, that it triggers in us, mm-hmm. right? So this idea, if we just are all happy and peaches and rainbows, right, then I'm in a, and I actually have a client that I've been working with for some time that is very much like that. So she herself has an incredibly difficult time. She suffered a very major loss in her early 20s, a very pivotal time of a parent figure, and completely just, you know, suppressed it, denied it, etc. So now she has become an older adult who will notice herself when even people very close to her, her fiance, her mom, right, even when they're talking and expressing their own sadness, unrelated, not about the loss, about life in general, she finds herself getting very frustrated and angry. Mm. And I think that then applies to maybe perhaps to answer your question, society at large, where, you know, when we hear someone else's discomfort, it makes us uncomfortable.
Right. And that's so powerful. That's so true. And I come from a community, and no shade to the yoga community, but like there's so much of that bypass that goes on where it's like, you have to be love and light. You have to be, you know, whatever, positive. You have to be calm to be spiritual and all these things. And it's like, yeah, but you also have to be human. And if you don't address this shadow side of yourself, you're not going to grow, and you're just going to be stuck in la la land, and you're going to have a lot of stuff that's going to come up, and it's going to be dark, and you're never going to express it unless you just own that that's part of duality. Like that is part of living on this earth experience. It's that shadow side like we're talking about. And that's so, because I was like, why is it that it's so unacceptable? But it's true. And for each of us, it's different. Like I know sometimes I have problems dealing with when I see people going through sadness. I just don't feel like I just freeze, and I'm like, I don't know how to handle this. Whereas in like, you know, other emotions, I'm just fine. And I know with my partner, he's different, you know, with anger. He doesn't really know how to work with that or express it. And this all comes from the way that we were raised. And I just think that's so fascinating as to why it's just not talked about. And that's also why I so much appreciate what you do, because you bring these things to light in a very public way. And lots of people feel safe enough, I think, in comments and things like that to express what they're going through as well. And then you just learn from that. You learn you're not the only one, and you don't feel crazy.
I literally get chills at, you know, when I see the people that are sharing what they're sharing, and I learn from my community and from what they do share in the comments. And part of, like I said earlier, one of my major motivators for going into this more public sphere was the reality, at least in my opinion, that there's a loneliness about healing. And I really did want to be able to reach out there and connect with other people who were maybe walking my journey. I am floored, however, at the amount of other people that were out there. But yeah, I think that speaking honestly and truthfully and hearing the people share, you know, what they're going through has been an incredible, invaluable, not only learning experience for me, but part of my own healing journey. And you're right. I actually just wrote a post today, and the amount of people that are saying, oh, thank you, I'm not crazy. This is just like, you know, just stuff that's not being talked about. And, right. You know, I am just so, you know, thankful that finally that we can connect and understand, and people can feel a little more normal.
Well, I think especially it is a lot from you because you are a therapist. So if it was just a normal person that it doesn't have a degree or doesn't have the experience in this field saying their experience, like, that will help people. But when it's someone that has all this knowledge and then they still come forth with their experience and say, no, I'm still human, I think that's what really holds space for a lot of people. So now I just want to, because we don't have too much time left, so I just want to kind of shift gears and talk a little bit about the subconscious, because you do a lot of work with that. You talk a lot about it spiritually in many different cultures. It's called many different things: the oversoul, the subconscious, the seat of the soul. Like, there's so many different ways to refer to this, our higher self. But I'm going to just read a quote that you wrote about it, because I just found this so profound. And then maybe you could speak to that a little bit. So you wrote in one of your posts, "Subconscious is the programming created before age 7. As children, our brainwaves soak in every single thing that we are told. We don't have a choice in if we believe it or don't believe it. Our subconscious mind is created primarily from our parents, than from our school, peers, and society. The programming contains all of our core beliefs about who we, in air quotes, are and what our space is in this world. It dictates our beliefs about money, religion, our abilities, other people, the world, and everything in between. This is our reality, and we've never questioned if it's true or not. We spend 95% of our lives there on autopilot." So that's like, it's huge. So knowing that, and also the first time I really heard that, and how the mind's in a theta state until the age of 7 in a hypnotic state, you're like, oh my God, I really do need to relinquish myself of all responsibility for things that maybe that were negative or traumatic that happened to me as a child. Cause that there, it's like a scientific fact. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, okay, well, how can we start to change and alter the subconscious mind or tap into it without undergoing hypnosis or, you know, seeing a professional in that way, if we really have access to it in our waking lives?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, and I wanted to acknowledge there is a value. We need, to some extent, that subconscious. We cannot, as humans, attend and remember, you know, and kind of consciously attend to all the things that we navigate daily. Mm-hmm. So there's value in it. But I think we need to be, like you're saying, and, you know, I wrote, acutely aware of what we're running on and what is in there. And one of the best ways, first and foremost, is to develop, I'm such a big proponent of any version of a meditation mindfulness practice, which allows us ultimately to step back. And, you know, as a lot of you in the your community, and if you ever listen to a guided meditation, you'll hear words like an observer's or a witness stance, right? So being able to watch our thoughts, not only while we're meditating, but throughout our day, because our day is where our patterns, where our triggers, if you will, occur. Mm-hmm. So first and foremost, we need to observe what our essentially our thinking mind is saying, our inner voice, whatever you want to call it, what we're saying to ourselves, what we're repeating, you know, what we're believing throughout our day. And when, as you start to observe, and I'll take clients through this, I'll teach them the tool, and then their task is to go observe. And what you'll notice is there are patterns. There's patterns in the thoughts we're having. There's patterns in our ways of being. If you, as the more we are able to observe ourselves, the more we're able to make sense. And in the patterns is where those programs, those beliefs, et cetera, lie. So first is the awareness. Okay, what is going on? You know, what is happening in each of this, in every context that, you know, results in me doing this? What's going on? What am I saying to myself? What am I experiencing? Mm-hmm. That gives us clues into kind of what is going on at that deepest level. And then once we're now aware, we need to first get out of, you know, not run by that programming. So really work our consciousness so that when that thought comes, I don't use that old reaction that doesn't work anymore. So we need to stop strengthening, you know, kind of that belief system or that pattern behavior or whatever it is. And then ultimately over time, we need to then start to give ourselves new thoughts to think, new feelings to have, new choices that we make. We literally need to then start to practice being different and being, for most of us, what ends up being more in alignment with who we are, mm-hmm. with not that belief that was told to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as a teacher, I've trained a lot of teachers, I mentor a lot of teachers, and a huge part, this is just an example, is when they're talking and they're teaching, I call them filler words. They'll say things like or good or whatever it is. Everybody has their words. It's like this process, first when they become aware of it, then now every time that they're in front of people, now it's just being flagged. So there's this like light bulb or this flag that comes up, and that's the process. Yep. And then the second step is, oh, you start to catch yourself, like the flag goes up before the word comes out. And then the third step is like, now you can implant new, new ideas, new language, new vocabulary, now that you have that space, but it's this process. And it takes a lot longer, obviously, when it's our psyche and it's our life.
Right.
yeah. And can you speak a little bit to triggers? And because I really believe triggers are just our teachers. They're showing us areas of our life that are unhealed. But when someone comes in, there's, I think, this tendency when they get triggered to immediately go into the victim and be like, that was them. It's all mm-hmm. their fault, and not really see the lesson in it. So can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the way that the marker that I suggest, you know, that people use for a trigger is anytime we have a big feeling. And again, usually when you observe yourself, you'll find that you tend to have typical pattern feelings. I always feel angry in this, or I always feel victimized in this way, right? So I think, you know, first and foremost, it's to understand that when we have what one might say is a disproportionate response, you know, to whatever happened mm-hmm. in our current moment, that there is something deeper going on. So that's our kind of our flag, that this is not just about the dish that was left out or the trash that wasn't taken out, right? There is something else for us happening in that moment. And then, like you said, I love that process. It's about observing and understanding and, you know, what is going on, you know, for us in that deeper level. And again, I want to throw out there and acknowledge for all of us in these acute moments where we are, if you will, triggered, it's going to be that's not going to be where we're going to make the headway immediately, at least. Obviously, that's the goal mm-hmm. over time. Mm-hmm. But what starts to happen is first it starts to be like a post game, you know, kind of, okay, what was going on? What was I thinking? Was I mm-hmm. feeling, et cetera? But then I love what you said, how the way you kind of worked with those filler words, right? And then we kind of speed that up. And now it can happen closer to the end of the fight, if you will, right? And mm-hmm. then during it. But yeah, there's value in there. And I think if we start to question, you know, what was happening for us? What was I thinking? What feeling did that result in? What meaning am I assigning to the dish or the trash, right? Starting to really just explore for ourselves what was going on, that is how we learn to view our triggers as teachers. But like I said, for some of us, that starts happening, right, in the more post-game mentality. Mm-hmm. We work to get savvy and conscious, you know, as it's happening in the moment, and that for sure can happen. But when we're emotionally activated, it's very difficult, I think, to shift into that observational stance.
Oh my gosh, yeah. It's so funny when you said the disproportionate response to what is happening. Because when I'm really triggered, I'm like, this is a completely proportionate response to what's happening.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's totally warranted.
Right.
And before you know it, I've smashed the dish.
Right.
I think that's absolutely, and you know who's going to do it? Whoever left the dish is going to clean that up, not me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Exactly. And then, like, you know, an hour goes by and you're like, oh.
Yeah, oops. So I'm not breaking up. Okay.
Oh, my God. It's so funny. It's good that we can laugh about this now, because this is such a part of the human journey. And so, yeah, and I know a lot of the work that you do with also the subconscious mind and kind of reprogramming after deprogramming it is this thing called future self journaling. So could you just speak a little bit to that? Sorry about the construction, by the way, in the background.
This is... Oh, I don't even hear. No, okay. I was actually going to allude to that earlier because, yeah, to speak to your point of bringing up the consciousness, I think that's a great tool. So essentially what it is, you know, picking one habit. Habits take a long time to change, so committing to at least 30 days. And then every morning I have a template, so anyone who's interested, if they want to sign up for my email list on my website, yourholisticpsychologist.com, that'll get sent right to you. So it's a template and it takes you through, essentially the exercise is bringing to consciousness each morning or evening, whenever you choose to journal, what it is that you're intending to work on, the habit that you want to break, and the new ways that you're going to show up, you know, exercising the new habit in your daily life. And I find I've used this tool extensively myself, which is why I'm now sharing it with everyone. I find that even just bringing it to consciousness makes us more observant of ourselves, giving us that critical moment of choice as our day unfolds to start to make those new choices. And the more we practice making those new choices, before we know it, the more we're able to start to break down that old habit and ingrain a new habit or way of being into our daily life.
Right. And you also speak to neurologically how it literally has an impact to do this work.
So new thoughts, you know, even if they're only thought in the moment of writing the journal, they are, our brain does not know the difference whether or not it's happening in real life or whether it's just happening in our mental life. It's going to start to lay down neurologically the new neurons, new networks, neurons that wire together, fire together, right? And before we know it, we have a new string of behavior in our mind.
It's amazing. It's really amazing that we can do that also on our own, like at home.
Amazing.
So how can people find you and stay in touch with you and see all the things that I've been talking about, all your posts?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So my big kind of hub is Instagram. I'm at the.holistic.psychologist. I'm on there daily. I'm in my stories. And to be perfectly honest and transparent, I do client work, individual work. I post everything that I do with the people that I work with on there. So if you come follow me, you will really get kind of all the tools I use and, you know, everything I talk about kind of right there on Instagram. So that's my major hub. I do have a website, like I said, yourholisticpsychologist.com. That is where the email list is and the journal and goodies. So if you want to sign up, I have a new YouTube channel, The Holistic Psychologist, but I post all about it on Instagram. So if you're interested in streamlining it, Instagram is the place to go.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on. This was such a great, great interview.
Of course, Kat. I totally appreciate you having me. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So thank you so much for listening to this week's episode. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe to the Soul Awakening podcast. You'll be notified of our new interviews and episodes that release once a week. You can find all the episodes online on soulawakeningpodcast.com, on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. And please don't forget to leave a review while you're there. If you love the information you heard today and it sparked something in you, feel free to share it with your friends and family as well. I'm your host, Kat Fowler, and thanks again for listening. I'll see you on the next episode.